constructing man-made barriers instead of relocating populations, and having the whole country have to pay for folks who want to live by the ocean?
And we just have 30 seconds.
That's a very good question. And it's the same question on floodplains, where we're now having more aggressive floods. But this is a very fair question. And I don't think there's an easy answer for it. The problem with Miami, we live on very porous limestone. So you can't put a dike or a levee around us and keep the water out. It'll come right up through the rock.
Dr. Harold Wanless, we're going to be back with you soon. Critical analysis, professor of geography and urban sustainability at the University of Miami, leading a project called The Invading Sea. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. It's 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude?
And thank you, Buffy St. Marie. Yes, our home planet is heating up rapidly, and we are going to continue talking about that this morning, as I have for the past 2 weeks. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm going to start out by actually talking with the man behind the board, the equipment there at the KBOO Studios, Ty Walker. Hey, Ty.
Hey, Paul. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. You know, I was realizing after the tree incident the other day, which I'll have you talk about, that I don't know if people fully understand that you and Sonia Buttrell, the two board operators who've been keeping talk radio going for, gosh, a year and a half during this pandemic, are two of the only, really the only people who've been in the station and operating the equipment live on the air and really keeping what, obviously, because I do this show, I think it's an important program and service, but I'm sure our listeners do too. So I really want to thank you for that. It's really, you've been doing great work for a long time, and you deserve credit.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so in addition to the pandemic, which KBOO has been operating steadfastly throughout, we had this heat dome, this massive heat wave, and you actually came in on Monday. I know when you came in, the temperatures had reduced, but still, it was remarkably sweltering for that early hour of the morning. I don't know if you want to comment on that. And then a huge tree branch fell in fright down in front of the KBOO door and blocked the station, so yesterday's talk show was canceled, and you weren't obviously able to get into the building. Thankfully, you weren't on your way into the building or get hit or in the building and get closed in. But yeah, talk about that tree branch.
Yeah, I'm glad I wasn't trapped in here. It's Monday. It fell Monday afternoon after I'd already left home from the morning talk show, the Monday Talk Radio. And so I didn't know anything about it till late in the day when Tammy, let me know.
Public affairs director.
Yeah. And it was blocking it fell conveniently in front of the two entry doors, and it blocked my way for yesterday, so I couldn't come in yesterday. for Tuesday's talk radio. We had to cancel that, but it knocked down a power line. It was quite a heavy, large branch. It would have been pretty lethal to walk under at the time. It was pretty big.
And knocked out the our internet service. Is that still out?
Yeah. No, the internet is working now. It's operating. So
oh good,
we have connection
oh,
there.
So it was so nice. Yeah. So go ahead.
Sorry. It was very. It was a nice relief to be in the station. We had just installed a new AC unit, so it was very comfortable in here. The climate control is very good inside here.
Well, I'm going to be talking about air conditioning in the show. I started out last week talking about. I'm going to get a little deeper into that. But yeah. That's. Some of our equipment produces quite a lot of heat, and I know our. Who knows how disastrous that could have been if it failed during the heat wave, but I know that our previous air conditioning unit was none too reliable. There's been many times I recall where it had gone on the blink and created bad conditions. I can't imagine what it might have been like to even attempt to be in the studio, which is just a small space, one floor with the sun beating down on the roof. Anyway, so yeah. I'm glad you're comfortable there, Ty. You deserve it.
Yeah, it was a big change from coming from a sweat box at home.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that too, people's experience of it and the implications of this. Anyway, again, I just want to thank you and Sonia for holding down the board operating for all these months, and I know things are going to slowly start opening up. Hopefully, I'll be able to be in the studio next week. Actually, we're again, opening up for the at least the talk shows, and then a gradual opening up process over the next few months. Anyway, so thanks again, Ty. I really appreciate it, and I'm glad you're there.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. And that's, again, Ty Walker, our faithful, dependent board operator for... He alternates a week, one week, and then Sonia Betrell's on the other week, and they have been, as I say... indispensable for the continued operation of KBOO, because it's nice to have at least some, I think, since I'm the voice, but I listen to the other talk shows, so it's nice to have some actual live programming. There's some music shows are able, some people have the technological capacity to be able to actually produce live programs on the air. There's a handful of them at the station. It's always nice to hear those. And, the immediacy of live radio is one of the things that I personally love about it, and I hope you do too. Anyway, so one more thank you to all our listener supporters who finance the station and helped us buy and install a new air conditioning unit at the station. And you can continue to support us by going to kboo.fm. There's a oh-so-easy support button to click on. All right, so to the task at hand, the subject at hand today, the number to call in, I'm by myself again, 503-231-8187. First, a couple of, I would say, fun facts, but they're not very fun at all, from my old friend Jeffrey St. Clair, of the Counterpunch News magazine. Portland's high temperature on Monday was 40 degrees above normal, 4.5 standard deviations, if you know what that means, from the mean, making it the most severe heat wave ever recorded in North America. You get that? Most severe heat wave ever recorded in North America. The kind of event only expected to happen every 400 years, like the 1,000-year floods that are happening every few years now. But these kinds of deviations almost never happen in summer. Portland's deviation from the norm would be like Dallas hitting 134 degrees Fahrenheit or Madrid hitting 124 degrees. And that's courtesy of Robert Rode Berkeley Earth, by way of, I said, Jeffrey St. Clair of the Counterpunch News magazine. And another fun fact from Jeffrey. On Sunday afternoon, Lytton, British Columbia, broke the record for the hottest temperature ever recorded in Canada with a measurement of 46.6 degrees centigrade. That's 116 Fahrenheit. Then it broke that record again on Monday, and again on Tuesday with a high of 49 degrees Celsius. That's 121 degrees Fahrenheit, shattering the old heat record of 84 years ago by 8 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, so I'm sure we could repeat that ad infinitum, ad nauseum, as records, heat records have been shattered across the region as this extraordinary heat dome descended upon us. So, let's talk about this, shall we? Those of us listening in the Pacific Northwest, we all lived through it. Of course, we all experienced it very, very differently, depending on our ability to avail ourselves of means to keep ourselves cool. Houseless folks had very great difficulty. Of course, they could go to cooling centers if they were able to get themselves, far across town, if that's what they had to do. Of course, TriMet shut down, which for 2 days made that even more difficult. I mean, of course, we know that I think under 50% of people in Portland and Seattle, even less, have air conditioning because we don't experience this kind of heat, do we? So it was a shocker. It scared me. Even the idea of going out into that heat during the most severe time scared me. It scared me being out in it the few times I was out in it. We're going to talk about air conditioning as one of the huge contradictions in this situation. The idea that air conditioning can save us is obviously a dangerous delusion. I'm going to read some articles about the realities of the air conditioning's role in the climate crisis and such. But we're living through this in a very personal way. And I think I mentioned last week, I scrambled to find, as I was preparing for this, and then I was talking about 107 degrees. And boy, the difference between 107 and 116 is rather great. And we had no idea what was coming, just like we really have no idea what is coming down the road at us with climate change itself. I hope we can at least start to agree on that basic fact, because the ability to really even agree on what's really happening, what caused it, and how to address it is distressingly lacking. So anyway, I ran down to the basement to get one of those portable air conditioning units. I thought I was, I thought I was only really saving my mom, that I would be able to, tough it out. And because I basically don't like air conditioning. I don't like going from air conditioning to non-air conditioning. I just don't like the feel of it anymore, really. Of course, I do appreciate it when it's super hot out and I able to get to an air conditioned place. I'm a mortal and not immune to the difficulties of living with strong extreme heat. So yeah, of course. I think the more we're used to it, the more we adapt to it, which is one problem with the Pacific Northwest. We're just not used to it, so our bodies haven't adapted. And when it comes on so early, same. Gradually we work up to the heat. So anyway, I went and got a portable unit, but then my new housemate, who's been extremely helpful, I want to appreciate them, reminded me that I had a small window unit also down there. I can't even remember how I acquired that, but so then I decided I better put that in the living room, so my mom didn't have to be totally holed up in her bedroom. But then I realized I need this. I live upstairs, and it was hot upstairs, and just a fan was difficult. And I'm used to opening my window at a certain hour of the night when it gets hot and feeling and breathing in, you know, I get a sort of a claustrophobia when it gets too hot. You get that stuffy air, you know, and there's that relief of feeling that in my nostrils really helps me get to sleep. But that wasn't to happen, so I actually moved and slept down in the downstairs room with the door to the living room open. Anyway, I don't want to bore you, you know, with my own, but you know, this is our experiences are important. This was an unprecedented thing that happened, and it's all too easy once we get the relief of the heat subsiding and getting the more normal nighttime temperatures, which allow, you know, the temperature to kind of reset instead of continuing to build as it did during those 3 days of, you know, topping 100 degrees. It's too easy to just, you know, think, oh, that was an anomaly, oh, you know, oh, what a relief, you know, oh, we can get along with our normal lives again, et cetera, et cetera. No, this is a siren going off in our ears, should be a siren going off in our ears 24/7, not allowing us to go back to our so-called normal lives. This is, you know, we don't want to live in a world where heat waves like this become a regular occurrence, do we? I don't think so. So what are we going to do about it? Is there anything to do about it? We need to address this seriously, folks. There's no hiding from this, folks. There's no delegating it even. You know, sure, of course, political solutions, Green New Deal, demanding our politicians do some, of course. But, you know, I think it's way past time for much more direct action. You know, there's people who are financing this. There are people who are profiting off of this. You know, the people who sell us, the big corporations who produce refrigeration units who are probably making record profits right now. No, that's no solution. I'm sorry, it's just not going to work. So, you know, I hate the feeling of powerlessness about this. I do. I hate it. I hate feeling myself becoming fatalistic about it. I hate that people have so many illusions about it. So many of us are living in la-la land about this and not addressing, not even trying to think about what the actual causes behind this are, which are clearly in a capitalist industrial system, which is what created all these machines, created the drive for accumulation of profit on the basis of all this machinery and all this vast productive capacity that we have developed. You know, I hate it that we can't summon up some kind of large-scale popular revolt in the face of this. It just galls me that we're in this situation, that it's just a steamroller rolling along. All right, so before I go to the phones, 503-231-8187, and I have a nice note on Facebook from Ty. It says, it's been a pleasure working with me and looks forward to seeing me in person at the station. That's responding to a note I made. I don't have to read that on the air. Excuse me, Ty. Anyway, back to the subject at hand. So let me just go back a little bit to the reality, of what hit us, okay? You know, the first thing we have to understand is what actually is happening in the climate. That's a first basic step. You know, and then there's, as I said, the deeper historical causes, technological causes, social causes of this situation. And, you know, there are technological solutions, but the problem isn't inherently technological. Technology is just a result of social and historical, social relations and historical developments. Okay, so this is from an Axios article, I believe, yesterday. The dangerous heat wave enveloping the Pacific Northwest is shattering weather records by such large margins as making even climate scientists uneasy. Well, I've been hearing the more woke climate scientists, let us say, the more kind of cutting-edge ones, I've heard them being uneasy for one or two decades at least. So infrastructure, including heating and cooling, is built according to expectations of a, quote, normal climate. Human-caused climate change is quickly redefining that normal while dramatically raising the likelihood of events that simply have no precedent. These risks include extreme heat events that can have unusually high impacts. I mean, we've been hearing of at least 100 deaths in Canada attributed to this. I haven't heard much about deaths. I've heard of, you know, extremely increased emergency room activity in Portland and around. That's for sure. I think assessing the actual, you know, damage. I mean, you know, the damage to plant life. We've heard about. I've heard on TV news reports about the damage to like berry crops for sure. I mean, I noticed firsthand my garden. I had to. Luckily, I'd saved up all sorts of materials to provide structures and then shade, various cloth and stuff. I was able to. Save much of my garden, and I felt, you know, guilty about watering it because, you know, I thought, you know, who knows, we're in a drought, who knows what kind of drawdown on the reservoirs might be happening, but I did do a lot of emergency watering anyway, you know, so I could see the effect on plant life. We won't understand the effect on our forests, on wildlife, you know, if ever, not for a while yet, but I'm sure it's had dramatic impacts. And of course, increased wildfire activity. We don't know I know there's a couple large fires burning on Mount Shasta right now. There's a Warm Springs fire. Anyway, so this is from Axios article. This is exactly what's playing out now with a region of the country largely devoid of air conditioning, suffering through unheard of temperatures over a prolonged stretch of time. In the past, such events have proven especially deadly, killing more than 70,000 in Europe in 2003, for example. Ironically, I actually lived through that one, too. I was in Italy in that summer. The heat wave is shattering all-time temperature records in the U.S. and Canada. Portland reached 112 on Sunday and then 116 on Monday, breaking all-time records, et cetera, et cetera. Because of the fact that climate change has made heat waves like this much more likely and intense, we might very well reach the tipping point of what our infrastructure and other societal systems are able to deal with. Friederike Otto of the University of Oxford told Axios. Okay, so specifically what happened? The heat dome over the northwest, which is a sprawling, intense area of high pressure aloft, causes air to sink or compress. As it does so, the air temperatures increase. Winds blowing from land to sea around this high are pushing temperatures higher. I'm sure most of you who looked out your doors or were actually out in it felt or saw that hot wind blowing from the east, which just is kind of maddening in some, I found. Anyway, studies have shown that severe heat events such as this one are now on average about 3 degrees Fahrenheit to 5 degrees hotter than they would be without the many decades of greenhouse gas emissions. However, climate scientists tell Axios this actually understates climate change's influence, since warming is also altering weather patterns in ways that make strong heat domes more common and prolonged. Daniel Swain, a climate researcher at UCLA, told Axios that the mean warming in the region is more likely a floor than a ceiling, given climate change's potential effects on atmospheric circulation, soil moisture, and other conditions that can amplify extreme heat. In addition, Swain said, a focus on tipping points within the climate system alone may be misguided. He also warned of systemic failures, citing the operation of the power grid and as an example of systems that can fail in extreme weather. Of course, here, thankfully, we only had localized system failures, probably overheated transformers. I actually haven't looked into that. I know that people in all the area counties experienced localized power outages. We're talking about hundreds to a few thousand, which is a lot if you experienced it. If you did experience it, you can call in at 503-231-8187. Talk about that. Of note, oh goodness, I just lost that. This is from this Axios article, Northwest Heat Dome article of a couple days ago. Scientists may also be missing part of the tie between global warming and extreme events, creating an even greater societal vulnerability to these events, since we're not properly anticipating them and hardening our infrastructure, according to Michael Mann, a climate researcher at Penn State. Mann and his colleagues have zeroed in on persistent, unusual contortions in the jet stream. I've talked about this a lot, which is a high-altitude river of air that helps steer storms as being linked with heat extremes such as this one, and the polar vortex in the winter, which ironically is also due to global warming because of its impact on global air circulation patterns, especially the jet stream. That's my addition. Climate models, Mann says, don't come close to simulating how such patterns are changing in frequency and magnitude as the world warms. The bottom line, if our decision makers do not take this heat wave as a harbinger of things to come and act quickly to adopt the climate change policies we all know are needed, I fear for the future of humanity. Gene Flemma, an oceans policy expert living in Portland, told Axios on Sunday. This is not sustainable in a city like Portland that was not built for this scenario. So again, that's an article that came out on January 28th. Two days ago, Northwest Heat Dome signals global warming's march. So that's that. Now I want to get on to, let me just check in, see, we don't have any callers yet. We do have Linda. So yeah, it's a pause. So let's go to our first callers, or before I go heavy on the air conditioning as an example of the terrible contradictions within this situation. Go ahead, Linda, you're on the air. Do we have Linda? I think Ty must be on the other phone. So we'll just, maybe he'll let me know when he's ready to get Linda. So,
hello?
Oh, there you are. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Paul. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I just wanted to say that through the research I'd done, being actually a program host and interviewing people around this issue, it's my understanding that the southern oceans have warmed to a point now where the jet stream was sort of cut loose and is like flapping in the wind. It is the wind, but it's both of those things. But that old pattern of El Nino and La Nina and was anchored by a normally cool ocean, which is now gone forever. So, and I really appreciate you saying it. Do we want this heat? I was in a cooling center and more this last 2 days. But I don't think we have any choice about that. We can't put the jet stream back where it belongs. But we can prevent other horrible things. And this should be the complete, total wake-up call. Also, adaptations to the heat. I keep thinking about solar-powered window ACs to keep people who would otherwise, you know, get sick and possibly die from the heat, to protect them. And I think that's something that could probably be engineered pretty fast. And well, so anyway, those two things were what I wanted to say. I do think we don't get to go back. To an anchored jet stream and to no more heat domes. We're going to have more of those and floods and freezes and what happened in Houston this winter because our structures and our systems weren't planning on it. Even us thought maybe this would happen in 2030, but look at 2030, it's only 9 years away and we're already there. So I just wanted to bring that into your conversation, is sort of like facing what's happening.
No, that's I actually hadn't heard it expressed in just that way. That's because we do depend on a certain amount of regularity, you know, as mortal beings, you know, as animals on this planet, as living in ecosystems, regularity is like built into us, and the expectation and so the idea that I guess that breaks even maybe one of my, I won't say an illusion, but certainly a lack of understanding. I guess, you know, maybe I was sort of reaching for the idea that maybe, you know, maybe the sort of the polar vortexes would sort of, there would be so that established sort of a pattern, or, you know, but what you're saying is chaos now reigns.
Yeah, it's already gone past what was the extreme catastrophes we thought would happen, and we can't turn back. It sort of reminds me of like when COVID happened, we kept thinking we would get to go back to something. You can't, everything behind us is behind us. We have to be really thinking many steps ahead. I wanted to add to that that the oceans have approximately 100 years of stored carbon that is rising up out of the oceans themselves from the deepest levels. And I interviewed a gentleman, I'm not remembering his name, from OSU, who's an oceanographer and studying acidification of the oceans. And they can test the carbon that's rising, and it's 100-year-old carbon. So we have 100 more years, if we stopped fossil fuel use now, of increased carbon going into our environment.
And that's not even
really
bringing it.
Huge, huge problems to address, sure, to be able to just adapt as we try to go forward mitigating.
Yeah, well, that's not even that's not even bringing into the conversation the even more ancient carbon locked in the methane in the permafrost and in the sub ocean floor clathrates. And yeah, I mean that's why, you know, I think that's one of the things that leads to, you know, leads to a form of climate denial even amongst people who are very aware about lots of other things, just because of the overwhelming nature.
But when you end up in the hospital and cooling centers, you realize you can't deny it. You know, I think that it will only be our leaders that are hoping to deny it in the interests of the ruling class. I think otherwise, I think regular people have gotten it in a huge and very uncomfortable way, and very, you know, sick-making way. So we'll go forward with it. I wanted to add that in. I appreciate you bringing up the conversation and us trying to look at it. I think, you know, Greta Thunberg said we should be panicked, and she's actually very much right. If we could feel what I just described to you more than just this heat wave, we should be in panic, but a panic that we can tamp down and use to focus how to make interim right now solutions so people aren't dying, and long-term huge changes so that we can make a way for animal life to live on the planet.
Indeed, indeed.
So
well,
thank you
Linda.
Again, and I'll listen off air.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's Linda, and she's a longtime KABU programmer herself, calling in, and you too can call in at 503-231-8187. So I know there's just so many dimensions to this. I mean, you heard if you heard Democracy Now! Before, the link to the possible link to that condo collapse outside of Miami of sea level rise because of the infiltration of salt water into the sub floors of some of these buildings, especially one that was constructed in such a way that it couldn't deal with it, and then obviously the money wasn't spent to even address that at the structural engineering level, and then beyond that the widespread problem that sea level rise is causing, especially in the Miami area but elsewhere. Anyway, I want to talk about a specific contradiction that the idea that we necessarily turn toward, you know, when you're in dangerous heat, you know, your instinct is to survive, of course. I mean, what are we going to do? All commit collective suicide? I mean, I don't know, maybe that's a possible solution. How are we going to coordinate that? Anyway, that's a grim, grim thought, which we'll leave right there hanging in the air, as it were. So this is an article from Grist, How Air Conditioning Could Keep Everyone Cool Without Cooking the Planet. Possible contradictions in that in looking towards technological solutions. But, you know, we've got this massive technological infrastructure, you know, including our massive highway systems, our massive urban built environment, which acts as a huge heat sink to absorb rather than reflect heat back into the atmosphere, which is exacerbating the problems. All the machines that are continually running, fossil fuel transportation, factories, all kinds of machines, including our air conditioners. So the subhead, in a hotter world, people will need more cooling, but as more cooling appliances are installed, Earth will get hotter. This is from 2020 during the huge record heat wave in California. It's from September 1 of 2020. Last month, as a record heat wave roasted California, statewide energy consumption skyrocketed, forcing grid operators to issue rolling blackouts for the first time in nearly 20 years. The reason the grid was under so much strain, millions upon millions of air conditioners were running full tilt. It was a stark illustration of the challenge humanity will face trying to keep everybody cool as the planet overheats. That challenge cuts both ways. Climate change is driving up demand for air conditioning, refrigeration, and other technologies that keep us and our food cool. Yet, cooling makes a sizable contribution to the climate crisis. And they have, you know, lots of footnotes and references in this article from Grist of last year, how air conditioning could keep everyone cool without cooking the planet. The challenge cuts both ways. Climate change is driving up demand for air conditioning, refrigeration, other technologies. Oh, I already read that. In 2018, cooling equipment accounted for 17% of global electricity demand, according to a recent UN report. Most of the electricity powering those devices were produced by burning fossil fuels, which drives global warming. To make matters worse, most of today's refrigerators and ACs use a class of coolants called hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, themselves greenhouse gases, thousands of times more powerful than carbon dioxide. The problem is only getting worse. Globally, air conditioning use is set to triple by mid-century as warming drives higher demand in wealthy countries and as billions of people in the developing world gain access to the technology for the first time. I guess in a strange way, we could class the Pacific Northwest. We're we are developing greater heat. And so we ourselves will be turning more and more to air conditioning. I will be interested in the rise in demand over the past 2 weeks for air conditioning new units. I'm sure it was dramatic, both online and from the the heating and cooling services and stores in the area. So the air conditioners will cook us if we don't get our act together, said Durwood Zelke, the president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development and co-chair of the steering committee for the new UN report. This is from last year. The good news is that many of the solutions we need to make cooling more climate friendly already exist. We need to get HFCs out of our refrigerators and air conditioners. Well, you know, we got CFCs out, you know, the chlorofluorocarbons, which were creating a hole in the ozone. I know there's been effort to get HFCs out. You know, these kind of things, though, need to turn around really quick. CFCs were, you know, by all accounts, a almost revolutionarily rapid response to a dramatic global crisis. You know, we're talking about, I don't know, years, decade or more, you know, from the time it was first signaled to the, but you know, that in itself is record. But you know, when people got rolling, this was a time when there was more possibilities for multilateral talks and solutions. Of course, there's been attempts to do that for climate change, the Conference of Parties or COP talks that have gone on now for at least a couple decades that have, you know, led to the Copenhagen, the Paris, you know, the Kyoto, Copenhagen, Paris talks and agreements that still have brought precious little concrete solutions. So obviously it's devolved to nations and municipalities and states, some of which have been more forward thinking, including Oregon and Washington and Portland in many ways. Anyway, I digress. So we need to get HFCs out of our refrigerators and air conditioners, making our cooling tech more efficient, dispose of old and leaking cooling devices properly instead of dumping them in landfills. There's a whole other subject for 10 hour-long conversations at least, and design our buildings and cities to stay cool. Of course, you know, the touted Green New Deal, that's a part of it. to, you know, build back better, as they say, to retrofit our existing buildings and any new construction, you know, require much more stringent to energy efficiency and insulation and all that. If we can do all that, our quest to stay cool might not inadvertently boil us alive, they say very optimistically. Experts say that the first two solutions, eliminating HFCs and driving up the efficiency of air conditioners and refrigerators, can be accomplished by implementing the Kigale Amendment, which requires that countries replace HFCs with climate-friendlier coolants, while also creating an opportunity for simultaneous efficiency improvements through other policies and standards. The amendment is a recent addition to the Montreal Protocol, speaking of the CFCs, a landmark treaty from the 1980s that saved Earth's ozone layer by phasing out ozone-destroying chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, once widely used in cooling as well as packing materials and hairspray. While the HFCs that eventually replaced CFCs don't destroy ozone, they do destroy our climate, hence the need to update the treaty to eliminate the use of HFCs. Now, this article goes on at greater length and very, very detailed. It's worth reading, but we don't have time to go into all that. Once again, thanks to I'm on Grist now. Reading from an Axios article. This is from grist.org, How Air Conditioning Could Keep Everyone Cool Without Cooking the Planet, from September 1, 2020, by Maddie Stone. Thank you to Maddie and to Grist for that. Let me just check in. 503-231-8187. We're already over halfway through our program, but you two, like Linda, can join this conversation. Oh, we've already got Joe and Lee. Hopefully they are still with us. Joe first. Are you with us, Joe?
Yeah, I am. The conversation has kind of moved a bit since when I called in, and I feel like you kind of have touched on some of what I wanted to bring up already. But the thrust of what I wanted to say is that there's been two kind of big ways to look at how we respond to climate change, and I'm like using that word response to like set up a kind of vocabulary that I think is important for us to like turn into strategic concepts. There's adaptations to the situation, to the physical environment, and those are going to be necessary, kind of what you're talking about with updating the protocol around these chemicals. But then there is the necessary work of dismantling, of stopping the activity that is creating so much churn in our environment and is depleting so many geologically vast chemical systems and energetic flows. And that is always going to be the first step. And that there's all of this controversy over like BECCS and over the different kinds of techno tweaks to basically try to make sure life doesn't change from what we experience it as now, supposedly, in that kind of narrative. And some people just kind of don't have any hope because, you know, there's more evidence coming out that these are just huge gambles that really aren't that grounded in what is practical or like have hairline margins of success. And that, you know, kills people's hope or motivation for doing anything hopeful. But what's always going to be there in the first step of whatever we do is going to be dismantling this economic activity, dismantling the way that legal right and property constrain humans to participate in these systems. It's not just people who have like choices over things. It's these systems and the social kind of pressures that create the kind of hallucination of like voluntary activity that, you know, we call the labor market. And that getting rid of these things is like always on the table, and that we need to be focused on that, because that is you know, how we get going in terms of collectively actually being realistic about the situation.
Now, did Moses want to say something? It sounds like, sorry, I'm being...
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just making, it was a little slightly distracting, but not terribly. It's okay. It's okay. I know. I realize you have a child, and that's a reality of your life. And so, yeah. Well, let me just interrupt you, or take up the conversation that you're starting. Totally. I mean, obviously, and it's hard. Everything's so much harder for me, and I think for a lot of people, when you feel this pressure building, and especially, you know, like it's an analogy, you know, it's like when you're feeling this heat, it's really hard to think about, you know, organizing collectively. I mean, really. So, you know, and that's why, I guess, why I want to seize on this moment. It's like, now that we have a little bit of relief, we can breathe a little easier. Well, okay, let's address it. Let's not wait until we have, you know, five of these heat domes a year, a summer, and then who knows what the other times of the year, when, you know, it really makes everything so much more difficult and stressful. And so we need to use the times when we're not facing crises, such huge crises, what I think of, Joe, you know I know you wanted to talk a lot about the whole issue of degrowth, and I've sort of haven't taken that up, and we could talk a little bit about the Tay. I just want to put this to you, that to me, the whole issue, you know, capitalism is sort of the background of the driver of this vast productive enterprise, this vast commodification enterprise, this vast objectification, this vast exploitation enterprise that has enveloped the world and has pushed everything to the brink. And so a lot of people, you know, people, we still have, you know, these... There isn't a much of a common discourse on how to address capitalism that maybe there was 100 years ago. There was more of an anti-capitalist, you know, sort of thrust that was, you know, really threatening the capitalist order. Things have sort of morphed, and we don't want to go into all that. But, you know, the whole idea of degrowth is something I'd like you to maybe address. But I just one thing I want to put out. The thing that I see is because this really does need, like, large scale, you know, way to redirect energies, redirect investments, redirect our collective energies. These huge pools of capital that have been developed out of the capitalist system, you know, the financial institutions, the hedge funds, the equity firms, the banks that are investing, continuing to invest in these insane, you know, whether it's rental properties in South Florida that are now, you know, under the threat of sea level rise, whether it's, you know, continuing to invest in, like, tar sands equipment, pipelines, all these things that require a return on the investment, and the return on the investment requires greater devastation of the environment and climate change. This is a vicious circle that we're all in. And you know, or, you know, BP oil spills and all that. So I've put out this idea of, you know, seizing the corporate assets, which is just as pie in the sky as anything else, since we don't have the means to seize anything at present, you know. But, you know, there's like divestment strategies which kind of redirect investments. Anyway, there's these huge pools of capital that need to be redirected, whether they're seized by, you know, popular revolution, whether somehow capitalism can be reformed. I think that goes into the whole idea of degrowth, and maybe what you were going to say next anyway, or not.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one way to look at that is the federal government is investing hundreds of billions of dollars. It could invest trillions of dollars if it decided to, in infrastructure. And there's a lot of important things about the infrastructure that, like, we do need to maintain and invest in. But the way that we would be able to seize those assets is if we made them less profitable by investing that money in making public transportation accessible across the country, making it fareless in a lot of places, and making the use of cars less attractive. There's a cultural campaign there, but people already want to like not be bound by cars. And then those assets, you know, become losses for them, and it becomes more straightforward to leverage them out. And that's an example also not of just what we need to do, of what immaterially needs to be invested in.
Totally. Stranded assets, as they say.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Paul.
Oh, okay. We'll carry this on another time. Thanks, Joe. Another stalwart KBOO programmer. And well, I could keep going on the contradictions of refrigeration, which, you know, is basically just one sort of stands in for all the other contradictions, all the other, you know, dependencies that we have on these large technological and toxic technological systems and products that just exacerbate the, you know, in some cases like air conditioning, the problem that they're directly, you know, immediately address, you know, they address, which is cooling ourselves. But, you know, I could get into like the privilege, you know, the class privilege of air conditioning, all these people who keep their air conditionings constantly on when they don't really need to because they have the money to do that. You know, I'll include myself in that, although I, you know, the personal choice, don't like air conditioning and will do everything. And I'm privileged to, you know, own a house with my mother and have two wonderful chestnut trees, perfectly positioned, large trees that actually keep the house cooled. And the previous owners, it's constructed in a way, and the previous owners insulated in a way that it actually, that just amplifies its own inherent ability to regulate the heat internally. But, you know, it has its limits. And let me tell you, 115 degrees is a limit. So anyway, so I resort to air conditioning. Anyway, I can go into all that more, but I'd like to hear what you have to say. 503-231-8187. We've only got 10 minutes left. So I better go to our next caller if Lee is still patiently standing by. Go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, hi. Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. I think that we have to realize that we're not talking about weather anymore. We're talking about global climate change. And it's absolutely mandatory that we do something about it.
Well, that's what I've been talking about, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and, well, it's, you know, I just want to reinforce that notion, because if everybody talks about the weather but nobody does anything about it, it's an attitude that we can't do anything about it.
Well, the devil is in the details, of course. I mean, what can we realistically do? We're talking about financialized capitalism as sort of being, you know, one of the major overarching, you know, things that is this distorting our social reality such that we're trapped in a climate change society. So that's, you know, but what are some of your solutions?
Do as little as possible and only what is absolutely necessary.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, basically, I'm east of Salem, and outside temperature in the shade yesterday at 3:30 was 115 degrees. What was I doing? As little as possible and only what was absolutely necessary. But if we push that to a societal or a cultural level, then we're going to get rid of an awful lot of jobs.
Well, how does that happen, though? I mean, it's nice to say that, but does that actually make anything happen?
General strike.
I'm talking about systemic things, systemic economic social systems that are twisting things so that people are forced into making choices that they may not want to make. It's not just a voluntary, as Joe was saying, it's not like necessarily a voluntary choice to just do things differently. We are channeled to do things in a certain way by these big economic, social, and political systems.
And in my opinion, the only thing that's going to force the necessary change is general strike. We've got to shut this system down if we want to live on a biodiverse, livable planet in the future for not only our species but every other species, every other living entity on the planet.
And that gets into the contradictions of the current moment. I mean, general strikes were a not uncommon thing, as I mentioned to Joe in the previous conversation, at a time when global resistance to the capitalist rulers was, you know, arguably at its height in since the rise of capitalism. Since then, the capitalist system has devised all kinds of strategies, you know, including the warfare state, including, you know, the historic compromise with labor, you know, buying off labor, basically, including, you know, massive production of consumer goods, which makes people think that they are satisfied with the crumbs that they're given by the ruling class. And so the general strike has become much, much less possible. So, you know, what's behind or getting to a general strike is the kind of massive, you know, organizing that we don't really see anymore. So, we're back to square one, which is how do we get to a place where we actually have some kind of, you know, collective popular movements, even discussions, you know, even common agreements on what's actually going on so that we can get to the place. You know, I applaud the Democratic Socialists of America for, you know, under the Trump era, for like getting to a place where, you know, socialism, and they didn't really start it, you know, they kind of piggybacked on a discussion that was already going from, you know, Bernie Sanders, from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, from others that you know, that don't speak, you know, that aren't still trapped in the old, you know, Cold War rhetoric. So, you know, I applaud the efforts that there are, but they're still not amounting, I think, to what would create the conditions for the kind of general strike you're talking about.
Well, I think what will happen is that people will realize that the system is unworkable and futile, and they are just plain angry enough to be out in the streets and say, no more. We've got to do something now. You know, you talked about the east wind, east of, you know, I live east of Salem, and the fires, the forest fires of last year produced air quality levels of 967 in Salem on certain
days.
That
was the last time the Pacific Northwest was on the, well, that and the protests in Portland, but, and now we're, yeah, I remember that. That was, you know, we became a subject of worldwide discussion for our horrendous air quality, which is obviously linked to the climate change. No, it's dismal. Listen, Lee, I got to let you go because we're running rapidly
out of time, but
I appreciate your contribution, as well as the contribution of Joe and Linda. I would invite somebody else. Oh, no, we got Harry. I kind of wanted to have some last thoughts, but Harry, I'll give you 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. Coming to our ocean fronts near you, it just happened in Turkey. You never mentioned about it's a thing called sea snot. It's happening outside of Turkey right now on the oceans outside of Turkey. It's caused by a sewage, and the sewage is growing. And it's growing because of microscopic entities are eating it, and it's growing. It's a snot thing, and it's ruining all the beaches in Turkey. So I expect that to hit us pretty soon also. Like we have no any other problems with our ocean with the plastics, now we have to deal with sea snot.
Well, thank you, Harry, for adding yet another dismal scenario to our endless list. I'm laughing instead of, you know, pulling out my hair and shrieking. But yes, there's many things. But I'll have to let you go on that note, the snot, the sea snot. I just want to leave people with, you know, I don't know, I like to say this probably too much, but I do feel like our possibilities for responding are being taken away from us as we go along year by year. But I still do hold to the reality that they're, you know, the financial speculation and the big fossil fuel companies, the big banks that fund them, the big pools of capital that continue to invest in insane enterprises that only lock us in further to a global warming world. That's a huge area. Well, so J.P. Morgan Chase is the biggest funder of fossil fuels to the order of $300 billion plus. This is from 2016 to 2020 figures. Citibank is the second most, $240 billion. Wells Fargo is next. Bank of America is next. Then RBC, Barclays, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, regular protests, flyers at those. I mean, maybe people might consider taking their money out of those banks. I don't know. Who knows? Then there's the hedge funds and the equity firms. They play a key role in investing in financing the fossil fuel industry. I have an article about that. You, too, can find all these things. I know last week, unfortunately, more times than I'd like to acknowledge, I say I'm going to link to things, and then I don't. I apologize for that. I'm not as on it as I used to be. But it's 8:59. No one wants to hear all this. This is the end of the show. I thank everybody for listening. Thank people for contributing. Thanks again, Ty and Sonia, for being board operators. I'm going to talk to you next week with Jacqueline Keeler, my co-host, on Second Wednesdays. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7
FM. Want an impactful way to volunteer for KBOO? Believe in KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change? Then apply to be a member of the KBOO Board of Directors.